You're listening to a CNA podcast.
So hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Deep Dive with me, Stephen Chia, and...
Hi there, Otelli Edwards here again, back on Deep Dive.
Welcome back, Otelli. Now, before we begin, a little warning that today's episode contains some descriptions of suicide, so we do advise some discretion. We also have links in our show notes if you do need some help. Now, over the weekend, the Samaritans of Singapore, SOS, a suicide prevention helpline, released data on the latest numbers of suicide. One figure in particular stood out. The official number for 2023 was revised sharply upwards from a provisional count of 322 to 434. At the same time, provisional data for 2024, that's last year, shows 314 deaths by suicide.
And just to highlight that within those numbers, two things stand out. Firstly, more men died by suicide than women, by a significant margin. And that's a consistent pattern that we have actually seen over the years, but it is no less troubling. And the other thing that stands out is the fact that the number of adults aged between 30 and 39 who died by suicide, it made up nearly a quarter of all cases. So that is certainly a concern and an issue that we would like to address today.
So to help us better understand this issue, we have with us Dr. Jared Ng, a psychiatrist and former chief of the Department of Emergency and Crisis Care at the Institute of Mental Health.
Hello. Hi, everyone.
Eugene Chong, principal counselling psychologist at Seeding Minds.
Hello, everyone.
So first question, you know, we got these numbers in. They say it's a provisional number, you know, provisional 322 lives lost to suicide. And SOS said it was the lowest number in 20 years. And the number was revised then to 434. What does it all mean? Why this provisional condition? What does provisional mean?
So usually suicide data is released in July of the year. So it takes into account cases that's classified as completed suicide. So that goes through quite a rigorous process in Singapore. It goes through the coroner. The coroner will take into account police investigations, interviews with family, inputs from, for example, whether they find things like a suicide note, hospital records before they pronounce the case as a suicide. So these things actually takes quite a long time, and rightly so. So therefore, I think time is needed to verify whether a case is suicide or not. So the real number will take more than a year to come. So they usually take about 18 to 24 months later.
Okay.
But how surprising, though, are the numbers for the male deaths by suicide? It's a pretty high number, cases among those aged 30 to 39. I mean, was that expected, or, you know, is it something new?
Maybe I can start first, and Eugene can chime in later. So actually, men dying from suicide is a global issue. So across the world, in almost every country, men die by suicide at a higher rate than women. Usually, it's about 2 to 3 to 1. With the exception of certain countries like China or Bangladesh, I believe, they historically have got more females who die by suicide. Perhaps this is linked to rural pesticide access, gender violence. We are still looking at some of this, but that's also shifting. So it's actually not surprising that more men die from suicide in Singapore. I think one thing to clarify is that the figures released by SOS, whether they are provisional or not, these are what we call suicide numbers. We also have to look at rate. I think rate is a more accurate depiction of the suicide issues of the country, because you have to look at the base population. Like, for example, if there's a lot more men aged between 30 and 39 that year just happened to have, then, of course, the denominator is much bigger now for there to be a higher number. So we got to look at rates, and the data will come out later.
Okay. So not entirely surprising. Eugene?
Yeah. I think similar to what Dr. Jared mentioned, right, it's not surprising, because since like 20 years ago when I first started working, I think is this particular population is still pretty on the high side. And during this period from that 10 years range, right, there are a lot of things that men do go through, and it's quite challenging, especially when you look at the challenges in midlife.
Mm. So help us understand, yeah, what are some of these pressures that men aged in this particular group, right, 30 to 39, I mean, typically face? I mean, are we talking about, you know, job stability, family problems, mental health challenges? Help us understand, you know, what are the issues?
I believe that there are a few various reasons, but probably I would look at 2 to 3 particular one of them. I think the first one would be relationship breakdown. Because like people within this category, most of them are either married or they're having like challenges in their relationship. Sometimes this relational breakdown may actually exacerbate the tendency for them to be impulsive, or it could be other reasons as well. So besides work itself, relational breakdown could be one of the key reasons. Then of course, with that, right, there'll be things like the separation of children, if they do have, that will take a toll in terms of their mental health.
It doesn't sound like anything unusual that, I mean, men, women, you know, once we get married, we start a family. It seems like these are the normal stages that we will all go through as we start to grow a family and deal with work, career, pressures of paying a mortgage and school and things like that. So, I mean, has something shifted in this, or is it just the same but more of it? Jared?
I would think it's just the same. I think, as you rightly pointed out, I think women also face a very similar pressure. I think there is always this view that perhaps men do not want to seek help, and I think that is true. The help-seeking, I think among many men, is still seen as like a weakness. They must tough it out, they must rough it out. And going to talk to someone about their problems is seen right. as them being weak, lah. So that is an issue.
In fact, we should ask you about this, because you did write a paper about this, right? I mean, a white paper on the National Suicide Prevention Strategy, and you did note that, yeah, men are twice as likely to die by suicide than women, and societal expectations, gender roles, have all that played a part in changing the dynamics in the family? Because in some cases, maybe the wife is earning more than the man, or does he feel diminished at home, and has do all these contribute to the role of men today, and therefore, by virtue of that, some of them feel that they can't deal with it?
I think it's multifactorial. I think in that case, if you talk about a man who was, for example, he was working to provide for the family, and suddenly, under no fault of his own, becomes unemployed or have got a lot more financial debts, then certainly he will feel that he's overwhelmed, he failed his family, and that does affect his self-esteem. I think the other thing to note is that some of these are also risk factors for them to develop a depressive illness or anxiety illness, and that by itself is also a risk factor for suicidality. I think the other thing which we haven't talked about is that perhaps some men would then turn to using alcohol or using substances to help them to cope. It may start off as, I drink to help to sleep, I drink with my friends to bond with them, but drinking increases impulsivity, and that affects their decision-making capability, especially when they're impulsive, they're in crisis. So that becomes an issue that contributes to the increase in suicide as well.
Between 30 to 39, you're in the prime, you're in the peak of your career, and you know, maybe have a family with children. Why are men in their prime years again? I mean, why are they most at risk?
Actually, it could be precisely because of that it has been told to them all their life that is your prime year, and then when they enter into that group, it is where their ambitions collide with reality. I think that's when they realize that, oh no, I got young kids to look after, I have less time of my own, I can't pursue my hobby, my parents are getting sick, I got to look after them. And they realize that their prime isn't so prime after all.
So it sounds like expectations in a way also. And I guess very much from an Asian society where if you are so-called in your prime, people expect you to be, you know, working long hours, you know, climbing the corporate ladder, yet still start a family, do well, have a nice house, a nice car, all that. I mean, so in a way, is this a burden that has come about because of the way we live our life and because of pressures from others around us?
Yes, it does. I think these are all, sometimes I call it the stacking impact, because once you stack one over the other, there are a lot more of these like so-called risk factors that probably may emerge. And that's the reason why sometimes a spark actually can cause the impulsiveness of the individual to decide, I'm going to end it. So I think there's just too much stress within this group itself from 30 to 39, all the various expectations that all of you have mentioned.
More importantly, how do we help this group of men before it gets to that stage of point of no return?
I think that one of the important things is to reach out to them. Besides doing therapy work, actually I reach out to corporation by providing a platform for men and women, especially in the context of parenting, for them to actually have this engagement, reach out. And because of all this engagement, right, men start to be open about like the role of a psychologist, the role of a counselor, or mental health professional in general. then they may actually seek help through these means. And that's where I think the intervention can come in if they start to approach the professional.
But what are the telltale signs to begin with? I mean, how do I help a colleague or a family member? I mean, because some people really hide it well, right?
I think the things that we can look out for, warning signs of suicide, right, is really the things they say, the things that they do, or even some behavioral changes. Like, for example, if they start talking about how life is not worth living, they have no reason to live anymore, they are a burden to their family, or to society, or to their friends, then I think it's something to take into account. If they start to do things like give away their possession, like one day you start to receive things from
right.
your friends, right? Hey, this is my favorite record, my CDs from the past, I want to give it to you. Or if you start seeing them write cryptic messages on social media saying goodbyes or saying things like, oh, thank you for being my friend, when this is totally out of character, is to take note of as well. Behavior changes will be things like, let's say they have a lot of erratic mood changes, they start to use substances or alcohol, they start to be more socially withdrawn. For example, a colleague would always be going out with friends after work, go for coffee, go for a drink, go for a run. Then suddenly over a period of a couple of weeks, they start to be very withdrawn, may not even come to work, maybe on long medical leave. I think this is where friends and colleagues need to pay attention to them.
Right. So basically, you're saying there's a change in behavior. But we've heard of cases where, you know, right to the last day at work, they seem fine, so to speak. You know, we work with them, they seem to be interacting normally. And I come back to this point about earlier, you both mentioned how it's impulsive. I often thought that a suicide was something that they had been thinking about for quite some time, and then at some point decided to take the move. But could it be just a trigger, a sudden change that causes them to then say, now I'll do it?
Yes, I think there have been a lot of studies that have done, they look at what is the duration between a person having that suicidal thought and actually committing the act. Many studies have found that it more than about 90% is about less than 8 hours. And that's very worrying, right? And about a quarter will be less than 10 minutes. And you're right, Stephen, I think the role of a trigger, right? And like what Eugene pointed out, a lot of times it's relationship issues. We have seen things like the first broken heart or realizing that they've been betrayed by their partner. I think these are big triggers for them. Many of them would have already perhaps been a bit vulnerable, facing problems at work, having kids that is causing them some grievance, or having to look after aging parents, a sandwich generation. And suddenly you have these big triggering events. And that sometimes pushes them over the edge. Add into the mix of the alcohol.
So I mean, is there any way within that 8 hour window or even 10 minutes that anyone can even step in and just say, hey, you know, we've got you, you know, you have our support?
A lot of the times the programs that SOS does, and when we go out to do suicide prevention training or awareness talks, right, is the importance of family members and friends. I have so many cases that come to see me, especially when I was previously working at the Institute of Mental Health, is when it was noticed by friends. Friends noticed a cryptic message on another person's Facebook account or Instagram story, and then they alert their teachers, they alert the parents, they alert the other party's spouse, and that is when we stepped in and we intervened before something drastic has happened. And the other thing that I think would be really important will be the role of helplines, will be the role of accessible helplines, and all these advertisements about 1771 and the 1767, which is SOS hotline, to be a lifeline for people when they are at their lowest point, when they are considering that life is no longer worth living, they could call someone for help.
Right.
We need to tide them through that trigger. Mm-hmm. And many of them actually would say that they didn't know what they were thinking, they were impulsive, and now that some time has passed, they wouldn't have considered taking their lives.
You're saying sometimes the impulse takes place,
yes,
and in that heated moment, they want to react to it, but yes, if someone is there to tide them over it, they actually are able to pass that phase, so-called,
yes,
and to look back and say, hey, maybe that wasn't such a good idea.
So Eugene, would you say that more men now are actually open to seeking help, you know, as compared to previous generations?
I mean, definitely more in terms of the number. So, I mean, for myself, I'm seeing about like 20% of my clientele are male. 80% are female. So I think there's been quite an increase because more and more men, even when they are going through like parenting at an early age or even like workplace issue, relationship, they start to actually be open up.
How key is this opening up by men? I mean, because, admittedly, I think when guys get together, I'm not going to pour out my soul to you, you know, and tell you about all my, it just tends to be the way we respond as men. I mean, and that's not going to change entirely, right? So how else can we better help men in this situation? Is there a way? I came across this campaign once where they were, I think in Australia, they're just saying, just say, hey, how you doing? You know, so check in with each other, little words like that, just so that if the guy was in need, he would have someone to talk to, so to speak. Is it as simple as that?
I think it's about normalizing help-seeking behavior. I think a lot of times, maybe in the especially in the past, I guess, when men were to say that they are seeing a psychologist or counselor or therapist, people would think that this must be something really, really wrong with you. Are you okay? So I think if we have got visible role models, men who openly talk about seeking therapy, mental health, being vulnerable, I think it would really help. I really like this. There's this advertisement, not in Singapore, but in the UK, where the setting was in a football stadium. And they talk about seeking help. They talk about suicide prevention that way. I thought that is very powerful. I think we should also emphasize that showing up, seeking help early is a sign of strength and not a sign of weakness. I think that's important.
So do we need more groups, you know, like, I don't know, like social media groups? I mean, specific to men. Because, I mean, for women, right? I mean, we always chit-chat with our girlfriends. We're pouring everything out. It's just second nature to us. But, I mean, for men, could you have some kind of a support group? Or is it, you know, not there yet?
I mean, yes in some way, because it depends on the place. Let me give an example. So about sometime last year or 2 years ago, there was an organization that actually approached me to help their whole pharmaceutical industry to set up some support group for men particularly. So I think they are very proactive. They wanted to actually support men in this particular period and season. And they do set up this group and it's still ongoing up till now. Because yesterday I visited them. So I think that's good because that's where these key role models that's within this organization, they can sort out help from these people whom they know that they are part of the ambassador.
Mm. So in other words, it is kind of changing a bit of the stigma that comes with seeking help. Men feel the need to like, yeah, it's okay, I can do it on my own, you know, I can sort it out. Whereas we need to show them that in this day and age, it is okay to go and ask for help. I mean, are there any other practical solutions you think we can use, we can share with others who are listening in now if they are at the workplace? You know, I mean, if they do notice a colleague is sort of acting a little bit different, perhaps any words of advice on how they can approach that colleague and how they should speak to them?
Or even through policy, right? I mean, can anything be done?
I think many companies now have got an employee assistance program that offers anonymous support and help and pathway to escalate the case to a psychologist or to a doctor or to a psychiatrist if there's a need. I think more and more workplaces are doing that. I think that's important. As you mentioned, I'll tell you about policy. I think right now some companies even offer mental health days off and organizing like a peer support group programs at the workplace. I think that's crucial. Recently, I gave a talk at a bank and it was interesting. They didn't divide the group into like the male support group. Instead, it was for parents of teenagers, parents of kids going through PSLE. They have got all these impromptu groups that came up, and the audience, the participants were parents themselves, and both male and female. I thought that was something which is quite interesting. Yeah, it's called a working parents group.
If there's this one thing that you wish men listening to this right now in their 30s could understand about their mental health, what would it be?
Actually, for me, I think it is really the importance of self-care. I think that's really not emphasized enough. I think, as you said, maybe it's society, maybe it's cultural that 30 to 39 is where you're supposed to go and chiong, right, in the workplace. But I think self-care is still important. People need to be gentle with themselves. They need to seek support. They need to make sure that their diet, their sleep is looked after. They have to reduce their alcohol use. I think these are all very simple advice, but it really helped them to cope better.
Maybe break it down again. So when you say self-care, I mean, it's really taking care of yourself first, both mentally and physically. Is that
right? That's right. That's right.
I think for me, I will want to use this phrase that you are not alone. I think it's important to let this people group know that they are not alone. They can reach out to any place. And that's the reason why there are so many public avenues, whether it's the toll-free line. When they reach out, that they are not alone, they can reach out to the public service, they can reach out to the private service, anywhere. So with all this psychoeducation that's been ongoing for many years, I think it's really a good thing. It's really fantastic and amazing.
Yeah, and you don't have to wait till you're, you know, in a bad state. I think anytime you feel that there is a burden that you it feels too heavy to carry.
And there's nothing to be ashamed about, right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. There's nothing to be ashamed about.
No shame,
Okay. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us on this issue. And of course, we know there's a very serious issue. So if any of you are listening in and have people in this situation, reach out to them, offer them a hand to hold and avenues where they can reach out and speak to someone as well.
Okay, and obviously this podcast would not have been possible without our team, including Tiffany Ang, Junaini Johari, Joanne Chan, Saye Win, Ho Pei Ning, Nathaniel Fetelvero, Shazal Dalila, and Alison Jenner.
Till next week. See you guys. Bye for now.